Hello and welcome to Meandering with Myrn, a potpourri of podcasts by me, veterinary ethologist Myrn Milani. Join me as I ponder any and all things animal and human, what we know and what we don't, where we've been, where we are, and where we're headed. This summer I'm having some long overdue repairs made to the little house on the hill. One project required outside access to all the windows. Luckily, most of these were accessible from the ground or your basic ladder. But the one in my under the eaves, mini library, sometimes guest room for small people, was easier to tackle from inside. As I cleared the area around the window for the forthcoming work, my eyes routinely drifted to the books on the shelves around me. I got rid of a lot of books that were outdated during a major cleanout and downsizing several years ago. But I kept my favorites. And, as real books you can hold in your hands have a way of doing, I confess a few new ones begged me to add them since then too. As I looked for a place to stash the window screen out of harm's way, I glanced down at the bottom shelf of the small bookcase at right angles to the door. Although I care about all the books in that room, these books are my greeters. They're the ones whose presence I sense first thing when I enter and last thing when I leave the room. Among these is a multi-book collection of short essays by an extraordinary writer, physician, researcher, and biology watcher, Lewis Thomas. One of his essays, The Medusa and the Snail, became the subject of this podcast. You may be wondering what the relationship between a jellyfish and a snail could possibly teach us about the human-companion-animal bond. But that it somehow did popped into my mind and compelled me to pull out the book. When I discovered that The Medusa and the Snail, which explored the strange bond, was the first essay in the book of the same name, naturally I had to reread it. Although written at a time when our elders considered us boomers self-absorbed, the opening of the essay rings as true today, if not more so, than it did back in the 70s. We have never been so self-conscious about ourselves as we seem to be these days, Thomas wrote. The popular magazines are filled with advice on things to do with a self, how to find it, identify it, nurture it, protect it, even for special occasions, on weekends, how to lose it transiently. You'd think to read about it, he notes later, that we only just now discovered selves. But being a biologist, Thomas then goes on to explore what beings possess a sense of self. It turns out that depends on whom you ask. Ask two microbiologists who routinely study motile microorganisms, and they'll tell you that individuals within a species display unique swimming behaviors when searching for food. In fact, these are so unique that if you watch them long enough, you can identify specific individuals by watching how they swim. Mice, fish, and most certainly dogs and cats, but also beans carry self-labels, as do many other kinds of plants. This makes sense because we're all composed of cells, and all cells recognize their selfness. Well, except for stem cells. They seem to have no self at all, as they happily convert to all kinds of different cells, like tweens or teenagers taking on the characteristics of their favorite media stars. But while selfness undoubtedly fuels self-preservation, obviously none of us would exist were there not a sense of otherness too. regardless whether we consciously acknowledge our own or our animals' relationships with our respective microbiomes or the natural ecosystems. Without those others, we wouldn't last very long. Without a sense of otherness, selfness means nothing. But as always, it boils down to balance. When we or our animals' immune responses can't properly distinguish self from other, and friendly, necessary, or neutral other from pathogens, all kinds of medical problems may arise. The concept of selfness and otherness also brings up the question, where does selfness end and otherness begin? And that brings up the relationship between the jellyfish and the snail. When first discovered in the Bay of Naples, it appeared that this particular species of sea snail or slug had a parasite that looked like a tiny jellyfish permanently affixed near its mouth. Naturally, biologists wanted to find out how the jellyfish wound up there. I say naturally, because if you know any biologists, you know discovering a tiny jellyfish glued to a sea slug is just too weird to pass up. To determine this, the biologists then looked around for early developmental forms of the slug. That's when things really got interesting. Even though it appeared that the jellyfish had given up on their self-identity and were totally dependent on their slug host, the jellyfish still could produce offspring. Granted, all parasites produce offspring. Otherwise, some parasite species wouldn't predate our own. And like other parasites, the glued-on jellyfish produced lots of them, just like other jellyfish. But contrary to what you might imagine, they didn't produce itty-bitty offspring ready to attach themselves to slugs. Their offspring grow up to be full-sized jellyfish. Meanwhile, the slug produces larvae that initially grow normally. As the larvae circulate in the water, eventually some of them become entangled in the flowing tentacles of the medusa, which then engulfs them. If nothing else, this turns conventional ideas of hosts and parasites, predator and prey, on their heads. But there's still more weirdness to come. The jellyfish can't digest a developing slug larvae. So instead of the larvae becoming jellyfish food, the jellyfish becomes slug food. As this occurs, developing slug larvae compete for the medusa, until ultimately nothing remains of the jellyfish except for a miniature version of its former self attached near the mouth of one, now much larger, fully developed snail. Lewis Thomas finds this disquieting. He can't get his head around it. He sums it up by saying that the medusa and the snail and their relationship with each other is unique at the same time as they remind him of the whole earth at once. Think about that. The earth doesn't survive on selfness. Its selfness is composed of otherness. The planet and all who live on it depend on a balance of selfness and otherness to survive. Meanwhile, in their book on the evolution of the human domestic canine relationship, Raymond Coppinger and Lorna Coppinger, who devoted the bulk of their time to studying free-roaming village or livestock guarding dogs, describe pet dogs as parasites. Ouch! I won't delve into the compelling facts they mustered to support their case, except to say that these were based on the cost of the goods and services pet dogs consumed versus the monetary value of any goods they produced or services they rendered. This represented a human selfness cost-benefit analysis. How many hungry people could be fed with the more than $23 billion spent annually on dog food in the U.S.? in which the value of the pet dog's otherness had no value. Some people accept this analysis, others do not. But cast not the first stone, my pet-loving friends. In their own way, our relationships with our companion animals may vacillate as wildly between selfness, otherness, host and parasite, and predator and prey, as easily as the Medusas and the snails. The difference is that, unlike theirs, ours with companion animals often may play out in the emotional realm rather than the physical one. One day we may become so consumed by our own needs that fulfilling anything other than Spot or Fluff's most basic physical needs is beyond us. We rush home, toss some food in the dog's dish, replace the usual outing and play session with a quick circuit in the yard while we impatiently wait for the dog to pee or poop. We have too many more important things to do. Other times, our needs may demand more from our animals than they want to give. It irks us when we want them to lie quietly beside us and console us, but they want to play instead. Or our selfness becomes angry or feels cheated or betrayed when addressing their medical or behavioral problems demands more from us than we want to give. To some extent, we can chalk this up to their and our own selfish orientations. As Thomas noted, it's a whole earth condition. The important thing is that we remain mindful of it and don't let the selfness or otherness balance shift too far in one direction or another.
You've been listening to a podcast by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, and books about animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavior and bond sites, check out my website at www.mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the content of these podcasts are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music, Molly on the Shore by Percy Granger, is used with permission from Catova Arts, www.catova.com.